I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It looks like coronavirus infections in hotspots like New York City are decreasing, while 14 states, including Puerto Rico, have recorded their highest rates of infection since the start of the pandemic. Meanwhile, all 50 states are in the process of loosening their restrictions that have shuttered businesses and kept people home. Now, protesters have taken to the streets in the last 2 weeks to demand police reform, and while many wore masks, there was little social distancing, increasing the risk of viral transmission. And just to add to the confusion, a WHO official said yesterday that it was rare for a person who is asymptomatic to spread the virus. Public health officials pushed back hard. We asked Ezekiel Emanuel to join us once again on Radio Times. He's a physician, also vice provost of global initiatives, and co-director of the Health Transformation Institute, both at the University of Pennsylvania. He's got a new book out in just a couple of days, Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? It's a question he's been asked numerous times. He's also co-host of a podcast called Making the Call. Zeke Emanuel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
Let's start with this WHO official. It's gotten a fair amount of attention. What was she saying, and does it need reinterpretation?
I think it was an unfortunate statement. I think that's the best way to put it. We do know that very clearly people without symptoms can transmit the virus. Now, they may eventually get symptoms, so they may be what's called pre-symptomatic. But we do know that people are most infectious in the few days before they actually get symptoms from COVID-19, and therefore can easily transmit the virus without knowing that they're sick. That's the problem. Right. They may eventually get symptoms, so she may be right that they're asymptomatic in the end. They're not asymptomatic in the end, but the transmission happens when they don't have symptoms.
I heard her say, in fact, she was quoted on NPR, the newscast, right before we went on the air. And what she said was, as I can interpret it, if we follow the symptomatic cases and followed them diligently, we would be in better shape than we are today.
Yeah. And so that is that you're pre-symptomatic, then you develop symptoms, then you go back to everyone you encountered over the previous time. And that would take, you know, you would monitor and contact the people who were in contact with this person when they were pre-symptomatic. But the confusing thing may be that, well, if you're not having symptoms, you're not infectious. But that is false. If you're having symptoms, you could still have the virus and just develop symptoms a few days later, having spread the virus. And that's the worry.
So wearing masks, social distancing, that should still guide our behavior.
Absolutely. And hand hygiene, we shouldn't forget that. Reducing, you know, don't sneeze with other people, don't yell, sing. Those things get air from deep in the lungs and bring out a lot of virus and project it at very high speeds.
Should people who have been protesting, and I'm sure you've watched the crowds of people in all parts of the United States, it seems, over the last 2 weeks have been protesting for police reform. I did note that many of them, I don't know if it's most, but many of them did wear masks. That was good to see. But clearly, they were not social distancing. Should they all be tested?
So, look, I want to express my total sympathy with the point and the message that protesters are doing. And the fact that it's multiracial and, you know, really represents the whole cross section of the United States. From a COVID perspective, we need to keep in mind that there are four things that really increase transmission: closed spaces, crowding, prolonged time with other people. And then, as I mentioned, these sort of sneezes, yells, singing, coughing. The unfortunate fact is that in these protests, while people are wearing masks, you do have three of these four items that increase transmission. You have crowding, prolonged times, and then, you know, singing, chanting, and other things. And that does, I think, bode, you know, it makes it worrisome for further spread of COVID. And it's why many people are, you know, suggesting that we do need to enforce this. We do need to have physical distancing and wearing masks out in public, as well as the hand hygiene. So I think, you know, we're we're likely to see an increase. That's just that simple.
Even though people are outside, I mean, I know that's not 100% protection, but does that help to some degree versus, let's say, a crowded convention somewhere?
So, let's make 3 points. First,
sure.
Outside is dramatically beneficial, really, really helpful. Wearing masks is dramatically beneficial, really, really helpful. I also think that there's an obligation on the part of the police of don't crowd people in, forcing them into a side street or something, and then spray them with tear gas or pepper spray or some other mechanism that you're going to cause them to yell or cough or sneeze, because those techniques that you're using, crowding people and then hitting them with tear gas, actually exacerbates the problem of this virus. I think over the last few days, certainly that seems to have gone decreased as a police technique, but it was a very dangerous technique that was greatly enhancing the possibility of spread.
What do you make of the fact that we are maybe in more urban areas? I'm thinking of New York, but I think probably New Jersey and other large urban environments. We are seeing some decrease in the numbers of cases of the coronavirus, but we are seeing increases in something like 14 states, including Puerto Rico. What does that tell us about this virus?
So I think that finding, as well as two studies that were published yesterday, do confirm that good public health measures, the decreasing crowds so you don't affiliate with more than 10 people, public health, physical distancing, staying 6 feet away, wearing masks, and the other measures are incredibly beneficial. They do reduce the spread of this virus. There was modeling that was yesterday published by two different groups showing that, in fact, tens of millions of cases worldwide have been avoided because of rigorously instituting these public health measures. I think we saw that in New York. We saw that in New Jersey and Connecticut. That has had a big impact. However, when we either ignore the public health measures or say, guess what, we're going to open up without 14 days of declining numbers of cases, without a decrease in hospitalizations, we are setting ourselves up for a surge in cases. And what you've seen is in many states is a plateau. We have not done what, say, Italy has done, which is you have a big rise, but then you really rigorously put these public health measures and you see a symmetric and pretty rapid decline to very few cases of transmission. We in the United States in large parts of the country, we didn't rigorously put in these public health measures, and then we released them very rapidly before we actually had the number of cases very, very far down, close to zero. And it's that combination that I think has led to the, outbreaks in these 14 states mainly across the Southwest, but not exclusively.
I saw that New Zealand has declared, first of all, they have no active cases and they have essentially eradicated the virus. What does that tell us? That it can be done, I guess, on one hand. Oh, it's good to be an island. Okay, I get it.
It can be done. It's good to be an island, and an island with 5 million people where, travel in is severely restricted and includes, isolation. So I think this can be done. We can institute public health measures and prevent the spread and decrease it substantially. It's not only New Zealand. Taiwan, 24 million people, very close to China. They had many flights with China. They have 1 million Taiwanese working in China. They've had fewer than 500 cases and just 7 deaths. So they, again, rigorous instituting of public health measures, rigorous testing, tracing, isolation can work. But, you got to emphasize the rigorous there. And if we don't do it, with everyone participating, if we open up too fast before we've really knocked the number of cases down, we can get problems. You know, the whole point of this isolation and the physical distancing and the wearing of the mask is not, that's not an end in itself. What that does is it buys you time so you can institute a mechanism of testing, being able to contact trace, and being able to suppress any incipient cases. What we have to worry about in this country is we haven't used that the time of these physical distancing and other public health measures to actually get the infrastructure of testing, contact tracing, and isolation. And so that when we open back up, what we see is a rise in cases, not an ability to actually suppress the few cases that arise. And that, well, that's been our problem.
Well, we're here in Pennsylvania, which is slowly opening up. I believe this part of southeastern Pennsylvania in yellow could be going to green, which means open up with some restrictions. So on the one hand, you've got, and I also think people kind of chafing against some of these restrictions. So you have an economic need to open up, but you've got a public health crisis that's pushing back.
You're absolutely right. Look, none of us like a lockdown situation. None of us like to be confined to home. There's monotony, there's social isolation, there's mental health problems that result from that. Absolutely. And, you know, that doesn't mention the economic impact on businesses of people. So we want to open up. But the choice between it's public health or it's economic is false. And if you look at all the survey data over and over again, yes, some people are coming out, but there's a lot of people who are not coming out, and business activity, even when you open up without good public health measures, has actually declined. You know, you don't get 75% or 80% of people returning. There are many, many people who are very hesitant to engage in activity, to go to restaurants, to go into stores, precisely because the public health measures have not been adequately instituted. So I think, you know, what we learn or should learn is, you know, to get the public health measures in place is going to be essential to having a vibrant economy. And I think that's the kind of thing we have to understand. And unfortunately, I think it's been a little garbled, the sort of, you know, like many things in our society, we've made a tension, you know, it's either economics or it's public health. That's not the way this COVID crisis is going. And if we open up too rapidly, we end up with a big, large increase in number of cases. And then we're going to have to reimpose these restrictions or let a lot of people get sick. And unfortunately, some of them will die.
Well, I do want to pick up on that, but we have to first take a very short break talking with Ezekiel Emanuel, once again on Radio Times. Again, he's a physician, vice provost of global initiatives, co-director of the Health Transformation Institute. They are both at the University of Pennsylvania. I mean, he's got a new book, which we'll talk about as well, called Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Ezekiel Emanuel. He's a physician and bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about what we know now about coronavirus, its spread, its lethality, how it could possibly lead to healthcare reform. And we will be talking about his new book, which will be published in just a couple of days, called Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? I should add, hint, it is not the United States, but we will get to that. Zeke, you talk, let's say people, and it sounds like most people or many people are abiding by these public health directives to wear a mask, to socially distance, to not, you know, rush back to work or rush back to go shopping. So that's, I guess, the good news. Assuming more people are doing that and taking steps to protect themselves, what does the system need to do? And how do we need to scale up the kind of testing we need to know that who has the virus, who doesn't, and then what to do next?
Wow, that is a huge question.
But isn't that kind of where we're at? Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised how hard it is still to get tests.
Yes. No, we are now more than 3 months. If you date, you know, something like early March as the date when the country really became engaged in this, and we're now 3 months later, March, April, May, it is remarkable how hard it is to get testing. It is remarkable the fact that we have all these serology tests out there that seem to not be accurate and not be accurate enough, that we're unsure, well, are those point of care, you know, antibody tests for COVID, are they, you know, accurate or not accurate? Can we trust them? Can we not trust them? That seems like a failure of the system and a failure of the testing regime. We have had less attention on testing, but we're still way short of what most experts think we need to do in terms of testing people and in terms of making it easy and relatively inexpensive. And I think that's a major problem. Similarly, we're well short of the number of contact tracing people who are trained and can do the contact tracing. As I mentioned before the break, you know, buying this time with social distancing, with masks, all of that is only useful if we can get the number of cases down such that we can deploy the public health testing and contact tracing mechanisms to actually control any small outbreak. If we haven't put in place that infrastructure, we're just going to have a large number of cases coming back when people actually get, you know, interact and begin doing more social activities. And what I'm really worried about, Marty, is, you know, in the fall when it gets cold out and we move indoors. Right now we have the added benefit that we're out of doors and transmission is less out of doors. But when we move indoors, if we have the same frequency of cases, we're going to see big spikes. And that I think is really worrisome. We have time, right? We have June, July, August, September to really prepare for this. I'm just worried that that's not been adequately focused on.
Well, it seems on the one hand, we're both sort of late to the game when it comes to testing and then perhaps rushing out tests that are not as effective as they should be.
Yes, the FDA, especially on the serology test, sort of allowed a wild west out there that, you know, you could get out there with a test without it being certified by the FDA. And that, I think, turned out not to be productive.
Yeah. But can we kind of start, you know, roll back the clock, not necessarily, but kind of start over and say, okay, this is what we're going to do going forward. And these are the tests that you can rely on.
Can we do that? The answer is yes, absolutely. Whether we've got the structure at the White House to do that, I don't know.
So really?
That I think is a big problem. Yeah. You know, it's not like these issues weren't brought to their attention in early March, that here are the kinds of things we need to do. Here are the kind of task force you need to set up on testing, on contact tracing, and put all these structures in place. We've been promised for months, 3 months now, that, you know, anyone who wants to get a test will be able to get a test. Yes, we've got testing under control. Testing is better, but it's hardly where it needs to be. And that's just, one key element.
Well, let me ask you about vaccines or a vaccine. And obviously, that's something that we're all hoping for. Are you concerned that we will rush out a vaccine and it won't be effective?
Yes. So we published yesterday that we are worried. Remember, trials to test a vaccine, you have to have phase one, which is safety testing, phase two, which is efficacy testing. Does the vaccine actually raise the antibodies? What is the right dose for the vaccine? And phase three is a big effectiveness trial where you do a randomized trial to show that the vaccine actually can protect you from getting infected with COVID. You might not need the second phase, but you certainly need the third phase. You need to be able to test and make sure that the vaccine doesn't just raise antibodies, but it actually protects you from getting infected. And that's critical. We've never licensed in this country a vaccine that hasn't gone through that testing of effectiveness to show that it really does protect people. The big worry is, Well, in this warp speed rush to get something out there, we might say, well, it seems to be relatively safe when we test it in 10, 20,000 people, and it raises antibodies. That's good enough. Well, we've got lots of cases where that may not be good enough. That may not actually protect people from real infection, and it's real infection that we want. Ultimately, the antibodies are only good if they prevent you from getting infected, and we've had many cases where we don't know what the right immunological marker is that protects people, and we don't have to know if we are confident that because of the trials that the vaccine actually prevents transmission of the virus or other infectious organisms. If we curtail the trial too early just by showing antibodies, we may not know whether it actually protects us from transmission. And that is the critical finding.
Every country in the world is dealing with this pandemic. And I'm wondering whether you see this as a real test for a country's healthcare system about how its ability to contain or control this virus.
That's a very good question, and I think we need to distinguish the public health system from the healthcare system. It is the case that the main response to COVID is about public health. It is about this, you know, instituting these public health measures, what are called non-pharmacological interventions of the physical distancing, the face mask, the hand hygiene. That's really how the response has been critical. On the other hand, there are ways in which the healthcare system helps in that response. And I've noted that Taiwan is probably the country with the best response in terms of the fewest cases and the fewest deaths. And one of the things they were able to do very effectively was to take, they have a health card that everybody has. When they go to the doctor, the health card is swiped. And the doctor uses the health card to get reimbursed from the Ministry of Health. That health card gave them a lot of information on every patient. They also merged that information with their immigration and customs information, so they knew immediately which people had been to China, and so that they could flag for their physicians, you got to test this person because they've been in China and they've been to Wuhan, and we need to look. They could immediately flag people with identify people with respiratory symptoms who were tested negative for influenza and therefore might be at high risk for COVID-19. And that allowed them to really zero in on patients, identify who would be at high risk, and test them. And if they were positive, isolate them and do the contact tracing on people. That is an example of how a country used its healthcare system, it's in this case the health card, to really mobilize and quickly identify at-risk people and get them tested quite rapidly. So that's an example of where, you know, the right healthcare system with the right infrastructure rapidly mobilized can be quite effective.
But what we also learn, and this is more an economic question, but what we learn from this pandemic is when many people lost their jobs, at least permanently or temporarily, we're talking about millions of people, a number of them lost their health care that went along with their employment. Has this pandemic sort of revealed some of the systemic problems with our own health care system?
Absolutely. And that's a really incredibly important point. So before COVID-19, call it December 2019, we had roughly 28 million people, 10% of the American population without health insurance, still, despite the Affordable Care Act. And now, because we've had 40 million people or so become unemployed through COVID, millions of people have lost their employer-sponsored insurance, the main mechanism that we use to provide people insurance. A lot of them are on Medicaid, but a lot of them, you know, in the 14 states that haven't expanded Medicaid are not going to be eligible necessarily for Medicaid. And so this does create a huge problem of more people losing their employer-sponsored insurance. And so that is declining substantially. It's estimated it might be declining as much as by 50 million people. Wow. And more people on Medicaid, just when the states are don't have revenue to actually fund this. This creates a huge crisis of access, and that's just one element of the healthcare crisis that, you know, because we're dealing with the acute problems of COVID, has sort of gone under the radar. And, you know, just to bring it back to my book, you can actually look at other countries that do have employers involved in health insurance, and they actually have done a structure that better protects people, because each employer doesn't arrange for insurance. It's people get a choice of insurance, and there's a common pool where the money goes, held by the government, that then reimburses the insurance company when people choose the insurance plan. And that you can keep in place whether people have the job or not. And so that becomes much more stable rather than the system we have.
I'm thinking, too, of the number of people that don't have sick days, for instance, who work here in this country.
Absolutely. We have a number of problems with our social safety net. And I think it's been well identified that we have a very inadequate social safety net. You've identified sick days, paid sick time off for yourself or to care for someone who is very, very ill. We also have an unemployment system that doesn't cover lots of workers, gig workers, self-employed workers. Now, the CARES Act, that was one of the relief packages Congress passed, did provide unemployment benefits to those people, but on a temporary basis. So, you know, God forbid we have a resurgence that extends past January 2021, you know, a lot of workers will not be necessarily be covered. And I think, you know, the unemployment insurance is another situation, social safety net that needs to be fixed. And its glaring deficits have been highlighted by COVID-19. So, you know, there's health insurance, there's sick leave, there's unemployment insurance. You know, there's a lot to do here to really create a 21st century social safety net for the American population.
And that's Ezekiel Emanuel. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Zeke, let me get Dan from Winmore to join our conversation. And Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. There's one additional point in achieving herd immunity with the vaccine. Getting back, you're talking about the vaccine. You need to show that people who have antibodies that protect them also clear the virus. There's many viral diseases where people have antibodies, such as hepatitis C, HIV, Ebola, where virus persists. So if you have a vaccine that protects people but does not clear the virus, then everyone would have to be immunized, which just won't happen.
Dan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Well, Zeke, go ahead.
Yeah, no, Dan, that was an incredibly important point, and it's one of the reasons you don't want to stop a trial just by showing that the antibodies are up, because they could. There are these sanctuary sites where a virus can live in a body, in a sanctuary site, be, you know, hived off from the antibody and yet make the person infectious. That's probably less likely in the coronavirus case. But as you say, it's not impossible at all, and it's something we need to be aware of. There's a lot of complications with vaccines. Let me make a second point. There's a lot of complication with vaccines. Once we have a vaccine that's proven safe and effective, we need to produce it in sufficient quantity. We need to distribute it to people, and we need to get it into people's arms. All of those are critical, big threshold steps. And when I've talked to a number of experts about the vaccine production, you know, the rate limiting step may be how fast can we put the vaccine into sterile containers and ship those sterile containers out to be administered to people? And do we have a mechanism to administer to people? You know, if the CVSs and other common venues where people get vaccines are not able to administer a large number rapidly. So I think these are additional challenges that we are going to need to confront. And, you know, a new administration in January, it's going to probably be challenge number one.
Dan mentioned herd immunity. And Zeke, I think you and I have talked about that before. Is that the goal, herd immunity?
Yes, it is the goal. So herd immunity is when enough people are immune to the virus, either by vaccination or by having had the disease, so that the transmission rate is below one and the virus may circulate, but it's not causing this rapid explosion of the number of cases. It's actually decreasing the number of cases. And that is the real goal, is to get the herd immunity, which will probably, in this case, require between 60 and 80% of the population to be immune to the virus, so that we get a decline in the number of new cases rather than an increase.
So either they've been exposed to the virus or they have the vaccine. I mean, that's how you get herd immunity?
Correct. Correct. And part of the problem is we know now that in New York has the highest number of people who seem to have been infected. But outside of New York, we're talking 3%, 4%, 5% of populations having immunity, having been infected by the vaccine. And that just very, very low, nowhere near the, call it 70%, that we're going to need in society. So we're just letting the virus out in society is not going to be the way to get to herd immunity. We're going to need a vaccine.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And again, our guest is Ezekiel Emanuel. You've probably heard and seen him a lot. He's been talking a lot about the coronavirus pandemic, where things stand, what we need to do in order to corral this pandemic and to reduce the threat and the spread of this virus. We're also going to talk about his new book, Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare, after this very short break. And again, he's a physician at the University of Pennsylvania, also a bioethicist. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoene, and you're
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, Zeke Emanuel is our guest. He's Vice Provost of Global Initiatives, Co-Director of the Health Transformation Institute, both at the University of Pennsylvania. He's co-host of a podcast called Making the Call, and he's got a brand new book. It's titled Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Zeke, you said you've been hounded by this question, and I should add that you were very much an architect or co-architect of Obamacare, but this is a question that you have been asked, and you kind of resisted it, but then finally decided to do a book about it. Why?
Why'd I resist it and why I decided to do a book?
Yeah, well, exactly.
I resisted it for a long time for a couple of reasons. Reason number one is that I didn't think it would be useful to go to other countries, say Canada or Switzerland, and look at their healthcare systems, because we weren't going to be able to bring their healthcare systems back to the United States and sort of what one commentator called lift and shift it here. And so I said, well, you know, you go and study there, but you're not going to be able to bring it and plop it down in the United States. So what can you learn? The second is that I knew that there were a lot of rankings out there. And one of the things that happens if you just look at three or four rankings, there are now about 9 different ranking systems. They're all over the place. Some, you know, in one in the WHO from 2000 ranking, France is number one. In many other rankings, it's not even in the top 10. And so, you know, that there's a lot of inconsistency in the rankings. I'm saying, well, you know, if we can't even agree among experts, what good is it going to be? And, you know, it really was years of people doing this. And then I was persuaded that there are a lot of things we can learn And there's a lot of things that even if you can't take the whole healthcare system, there may be parts that we can take. And it was also, I think, very important because the rhetoric around healthcare was like, you know, it's either our system or socialized medicine, or it's our system or it's single payer. And that rhetoric turns out to be totally wrong. So I finally gave in and I said, all right, let me go to certain countries and see what we can learn that is movable and good lessons for the United States. It also turned out that those countries says, well, we'd like to learn about other systems, too, because, you know, we don't know that much about, say, Switzerland, or we don't know that much about Taiwan or Australia. So it did turn out to be useful. It will be useful not just for the U.S., but for all of the countries that I've looked at.
In fact, you looked at Australia, just so everyone knows, Canada, China, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, Switzerland, Taiwan, the UK, and the US. So those were the countries that you looked at. One of the things that you said was interesting is that all these countries, and they have different healthcare systems, face some of the same problems having to do with cost containment, having to do with an aging population, the cost of drugs, levels of inefficiency, unnecessary care, the problems of chronic care, the needs of addressing mental health care. So everyone seems to be struggling with this in their own unique way.
Yeah, so I think that it's very important. Sometimes we complain about our healthcare system, but to understand that there are some common problems, no matter where you are, about healthcare in other countries. Yes, we spend nearly 18% of our GDP on healthcare, way more than any other country. But it turns out even countries spending 10 or 12% of GDP on healthcare, they're also struggling with high costs. High costs for drugs is a common problem across all countries. And then, you know, these are all developed countries. This issue of chronic illness, it's not acute problems. It's not the car accident or the broken arm from a bike fall that actually causes big spending in healthcare. It's chronic health problems, diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, cancer, mental health disease. And so you see how are we providing chronic care is a common challenge across all countries. And then, as you correctly mentioned, mental health and long-term care are also big challenges, regardless of the country. So you have to look at common problems and you can learn from how different countries are addressing them. But then you also have to look at what's distinctive, what are problems we're facing that other places don't face. And again, given the 11 countries, almost all the countries had truly 100% coverage, which we don't. Even China is rapidly moving towards universal coverage. We are a laggard. One of the other things we learned is that universal coverage is in many countries relatively new. It's not like it's been there for 50 years in all countries. There are many countries in which it's something that came in the 90s. So I think that'll surprise a lot of people as well.
Well, and it seems out of your research, there's some sort of basics that should and could possibly be applied to the United States, universal coverage that you just mentioned, the idea of covering children at no extra cost, simplifying our healthcare system, regulating drug prices, something that we do not do, putting more emphasis and more money into things like primary care and maintaining choice, things like that. These are all things that we could possibly borrow or appropriate from other countries?
You've read the book very carefully, Marty. That's obvious. Let me just talk about something I'm quite passionate about, which is my father was a pediatrician, took care of kids, and I've had my own kids. And, you know, we have a unique system in the United States that if you have private insurance, you pay for your kids' health care. And the difference is huge. So just to give the listeners a sort of ballpark, an individual private insurance, if you go to, you know, the University of Pennsylvania where I get my coverage, is about $7,000 for an individual. If you're a family, it's around $20,000. And it turns out I, as an individual, pay about $1,200 for my insurance package directly out of pocket. But if I'm a family, I pay a lot more, over $5,000, actually $6,000 So it turns out that if you have kids, the financial burden on you is huge for healthcare. Yeah. This is unique. No other country puts the entire healthcare financing on a family. In fact, other countries that have private healthcare insurers delivering the care, like the Netherlands, like Germany, the government assumes the payment for children. They recognize children are a social investment, a social good, and individual families should not be responsible for providing insurance to paying for insurance for their kids. That should be something that all of society does collectively. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. You know, economists are like, wow, we've got this dropping birth rate and you know, what to do about it. Well, it turns out one of the issues is we put a huge financial burden on people to have kids. And one of them, maybe even the highest, it turns out to be providing them health insurance. And so there are different ways of doing it. And you learn this by going to other countries.
Yeah. Well, you say the one area that the United States does well is innovation. We fall short in just about all other categories. But to get the answer to the title of your book, so which country has the world's best healthcare when you add it all up?
Marty, you remind me of my students at Wharton, where, you know, they always want the answer without doing the hard work of reading. So one of the things we do in this book is we identify 22 different metrics that you might think are important in terms of a healthcare system. So we look at things like, how much choice do you actually have? You know, we in America like to think choice is important to us. Well, it turns out we actually have less choice than many other countries. There are many countries, Germany being a good example, where you basically have a limited choice of any doctor. You could see 10 doctors in a day, and it might not cost you anything. So, you know, it's like, wow, we want choice, but we've created a structure and a system that doesn't enhance choice in the United States. And so we've looked at, you know, where is it good to get, are we having the best care for people with chronic illness? And so we have 22 different metrics. So finding the best is, as I say in the book, is probably a fool's errand because we care about different things at different times and different bases. There are some countries that rise to the top along a broad swath of these measures. But, you know, you may have a particular set of measures that you think are really important that they may not. They may or may not do particularly well. And I will say the United States excels at innovation. And by the way, I don't mean innovation in terms of developing new drugs or devices or new surgical procedures. We are particularly interested in innovation and how you deliver care, this issue of chronic care or mental health care. We're doing more experiments than most countries and I think are pretty have some pretty nice models out there. Innovation in terms of how we actually pay doctors, that has for a long time been actually pioneered in the United States and then adopted by a lot of other countries, and we're still at the forefront of pioneering that.
Thomas has an email here. He says, how do other countries handle privacy issues and insurance rules that seem to act as barriers here? That's a big question, Zeke. Do you have an answer?
Well, it turns out actually a lot of other countries trust their government to keep data private. And so I mentioned Taiwan at the early part that they use this health data card where they get a lot of information about why you're going to the doctor, which doctor you're going to, and the doctor's charges. But they trust the government not to commercialize it. Only to, say, merge it with another database like the Immigration and Customs database when you have a public health emergency. The same thing is true in the Scandinavian countries. The government has these enormous databases on everyone in the country, but they trust the government to keep them private and to not commercialize them and to not allow people to hack into them. And so I do think in many of these other countries, there's actually a lot of data available on people that can be used to promote health, to promote the response to COVID-19, that we actually have lacked because of our worries about the government abusing the data or private companies commercializing the data in a way that we won't benefit from and we didn't consent to.
And weren't electronic medical records, wasn't that supposed to help us sort of manage and be able to share some of this information?
That is a very good question. So one of the differences between the United States and other countries, and again, there are only a few countries that have actually mastered the electronic health record situation, is we have a lot of competing companies, scores of different electronic health records, and they're not easily exchanging data. The big ones, Epic, created lots of barriers to the free exchange of data between different systems. It's a way of locking people into your system, and that has been a major barrier in the United States. We're now beginning, one of the things that not the Affordable Care Act, but the Recovery Act in 2009 did was to incentivize hospitals and doctors to adopt electronic health records. That has succeeded. People have them. But the big advantages of that are only now beginning to be realized, and they will require much easier interoperability, it's called, where the data can go back and forth among electronic health records, can go into a central database that can actually be useful for improving the management of patients in hospital systems or in physician groups. And so I think those are the advances we're likely to see over the next decade in the United States. Hmm. And by the way, the problems associated with electronic health records, not creating eye contact, filling out too much paperwork to put into the system, those are also slowly being solved. We have a lot of startups that are really addressing that problem.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Just a couple of questions before we have to end our conversation. I'm thinking about the Affordable Care Act, which you had a hand in creating. And we know that the Republicans have gone after, tried to chip away at the Affordable Care Act. President Trump essentially wants to get rid of it. What has explained its longevity in spite of all these efforts to try to undermine it and, frankly, throw it over the fence?
Well, there have been some things that have undermined it. The Supreme Court allowing states not to expand Medicaid has meant that lots of 14 states haven't expanded Medicaid, and people in those states may not be eligible for insurance, especially people with lower incomes. But I do think people view healthcare as something essential, and COVID has made this even more important. And I do think that is the main reason the Affordable Care Act has been able to stay in place. And I think we're going to see early in the next decade that we're going to have an expansion. We still don't have universal coverage. We still have problems with too high deductibles. We still have problems with surprise medical billing. And I think you're going to see an attempt to address all of those kinds of problems with the system. And I didn't mention drug costs, which is another thing that we studied extensively in this book. And again, we can learn a lot about regulating drug costs from other countries. One key message is almost all the other countries use objective standards for how much does this drug improve people's health, and they tie the price to that improvement in health. And that seems like a common sense thing to do. And people, most countries do it. And I think that's one of the common sense things that we really need to adopt in this country.
We're going to have to leave it there. Ezekiel Emanuel, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, his new book is titled Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. I should add, our guest also has a podcast, just like everyone else in America, and it is called Making the Call. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.